Out of the 51 states that make up the United States of America, Oklahoma is ranked 14th highest when it comes to their crime index rating. Oklahoma had a violent crime rating of 4.20 when last reported, which is just above the national median of 4. The odds of becoming a victim of a violent crime are approximately 1 in 238 within the state. Last year, there were 270 reports of murder, 2,313 reports of rape, 1,632 reports of robbery, and 12,656 reports of assault. The ratios per capita within the state rank above the national average for murder, rape, and robbery, and below the national average for assault. This week, we are going to focus in on the state of Oklahoma and talk about one of the most troubling things that we talk about within true crime, the disappearance and murder of young children. We will focus in this week on a case where the young lady at the center of the case is believed to have been murdered, and the believed culprit was murdered in prison. In this case, however, no body has ever been recovered, and as always, there is a massive plea for information then to finally close this case in one form or fashion. Hello, my name is Lance, and welcome to episode 125 of Gone But Never Forgotten, Missing With No Closure in Oklahoma, the disappearance of Kirsten Renee Hatfield. Kirsten Hatfield was born on February 12th of 1989. In 1997, she was 8 years old, and she was in the second grade at Traub Elementary School, which is located in Midwest City, Oklahoma. She lived on Jet Drive with her mother, Shannon, and her sister, Faith. Kirsten, when being described by those that knew her, was described as a bit of a homebody, who seemed to prefer the company of her mom, Shannon, and Shannon's father over spending too much time with her friends outside of school hours. Kirsten, though, did love the outdoors, especially playing softball, but she also enjoyed wearing frilly dresses and dressing up. Kirsten was also described by family as a headstrong girl who always worked hard to keep the peace within the family, except when she was told to clean her room, which would see her sit in the doorway all day, refusing to clean. On May 13th of 1997, Kirsten was last seen by her mom, Shannon, as she tucked her into bed. Shannon said that she usually read a book to Kirsten before she put her to bed, but because it was later than usual and Kirsten's younger sister, Faith, was already asleep, she laid in bed with Kirsten instead for a little while before leaving the room and leaving the bedroom door slightly ajar, something that was routine for Shannon because she wanted to hear if either daughter woke up in the middle of the night and needed her help. Shannon remembers that at around 3 a.m. on May 14th, just a few hours later, she woke up and heard noises coming from the room that the girls were sleeping in. She said that it sounded like whines or moans, and she assumed that one of the girls was either talking in their sleep or simply moving around in their sleep. Shannon got out of bed, though, and started to head towards the girl's bedroom, but she stopped when she heard the noises stop because she assumed that all must be well, and she didn't want to inadvertently wake the girls up. Something, though, caught her eye. She saw that the bedroom door was closed, even though she was certain that she had left it partially open. Shannon would go down the hall and again open the door quietly and just a crack so that she could hear if anything went wrong in the night. She says, though, that she did not look into the room, however, and she returned to bed. It would only be the next morning when Shannon would realize that something was horribly wrong. She saw that Faith was in her bed, but she also saw that Kirsten was not in her bed. Shannon says that she immediately became frantic, as any mom would, first asking 3-year-old Faith if she knew where her sister was, and then looking throughout the house, and even heading door to door down the street to see if anyone had seen Kirsten. When Shannon returned home, she called her father, who told her that she needed to call 911 immediately and get some help, which she of course did. When the police arrived at the home, Shannon told them that she had heard noises around 3 a.m., and police started first to search the house, looking in every nook and cranny that they could find. It was only on further inspection of the girl's bedroom that investigators would notice the first thing that led them to believe that they had a case that involved foul play. The bedroom was on the ground floor of the home, and the window was very slightly opened, and officers quickly noticed that there was a small drop of blood on the window. That was what made police leave the home and start investigating the outside of the house, which would be where they would find some things that were even more haunting. In the backyard, they would find more blood on a 6-foot-high wooden fence, and they would also find a pair of girls' underwear that had blood on them as well. Sadly, officers had to ask Shannon if the underwear belonged to Kirsten, and Shannon heartbreakingly confirmed that they were indeed the underwear that Kirsten was wearing when she went to bed the previous evening. Investigators immediately then feared that Kirsten had been the victim of a kidnapping, and police hit the ground running. Investigators were canvassing door to door, and there were even roadblocks put up in the area so that people could be checked coming and going. They even canvassed businesses in the area to see if they could find any security footage that would show Kirsten, whomever had abducted Kirsten, or both. The FBI was even brought in on the case very quickly to attempt to find Kirsten and her kidnapper as quickly as humanly possible. Unfortunately, though, not much in the way of evidence would turn up in the early investigation. Investigators were able to determine that dogs in the neighborhood had been heard barking at roughly 3 a.m., which did serve to confirm the timeline that Shannon had mentioned. A child psychologist was brought in to try and speak with poor young Faith, who, as I mentioned, was only 3 years old at the time that all of this happened. They wanted to see if they could get Faith to open up any more about what had happened that night and see if they could get any type of lead or information from her. The psychologist really could only get one statement out of Faith. Faith kept saying that a bad man came into the room and took her sister. She couldn't provide a description beyond that. This really does break one's heart. I can only imagine how much torment that probably still plays on Faith's mind to this very day, but I pray that she knows that she cannot blame herself at all within this situation. At the age of 3, there is not a whole lot that a child can comprehend or understand and then share in a situation like that. My heart truly goes out to her. Investigators would finally get what they believed to be a massive break in the case, though, through a tip that came through a tip line, when a woman called in and said that her boyfriend had told her that if she didn't start acting better towards him, he was going to do to her what he had done to Kirsten Hatfield. Now, as I'm sure that many of you listening at home do know, Sadly, this does tend to happen a lot in cases like this when a tip line is opened up. A lot of people, sadly, will bring up situations to look tough, and in return, people will call tip lines to report that, and also to simply throw other people under the bus. Sadly, a lot of time gets wasted because of situations like this, because investigators certainly need to follow up on tips like this one to ensure that they are not true. This particular tip, though, seemed to have a little bit more behind it, however. The boyfriend in question was actually close friends with Shannon's brother, who, of course, would be Kirsten's uncle. The boyfriend also had a criminal record for various things, including assault and battery. The problem, though, was that the man in question had what appeared to be an airtight alibi for the night in question. He had proof that he was out drinking after hours on the night that Kirsten had been kidnapped. So that tip wound up being one of those false tips and ultimately a dead end. Unfortunately, with not much in the way of evidence, first the investigators, of course, looked at the family, as they do tend to do. They looked into Shannon and they looked into her brother and others that were close with the family and close with Kirsten. Both close in relation and close in geography. A lot of people early on actually pointed at Shannon herself, who admittedly had had a rough life and a rough upbringing. But it appeared that Shannon was doing all that she could to provide a life for herself, Kirsten, and Faith, and had really turned her personal life around. As a part of the investigation, though, Faith was removed from the care of her mother and placed into the care of her father, who I might add lived many states away, and who, according to Shannon, had not done as much as send cards to Faith for her birthday or for Christmas in the past. This is the part of situations like this that don't get brought up very much, and they really do get glossed over. In Shannon, you have a woman who no doubt blamed herself for not responding quicker to the noises that she heard, and in interviews early on, she even pondered whether this was her past of drug use and abuse coming back and someone from her past taking her daughter. But not only was Shannon beating herself up, many people looked at her as a suspect or with blame. Further to that, though, not only did Shannon lose Kirsten that night, but as a result of being a person of interest in the case, she also lost her second daughter, Faith, for a time, just in case she had something to do with the disappearance of Kirsten. Now, don't get me wrong, I get it. I really do. If there's any chance that a parent is to blame in a disappearance, I understand that you need to protect the other child or the other children that are in the home. Of course, that's a given. But I have to believe that in the vast majority of cases, the parents are not to blame, and that means that the pain that they're going through is really only compounded in a situation like this one. For her part, Shannon stayed incredibly strong. She spent every waking moment of every day trying to ensure that more posters went up showing Kirsten and more stories were written about Kirsten and everything that could possibly be done to help find Kirsten was being done. Shannon even went and got her GED and went back to school to get a degree in criminology. She obtained work as an investigator working on cases that involved sex offenders, partly because she wanted to prevent other people from going through what she was already going through, but also partly because she hoped and prayed that she would one day come across something that would help her find out who had taken Kirsten. For a long time, seemingly, the case went completely cold, and then in 2007, there would be another tip that would come in from a woman to police that would reignite the case. A woman's mother had passed away, and in the process of going through her stuff, she came across journals, and as she read them, inside of one of the journals was a very detailed and very gory description about what had happened to Kirsten Hatfield. The journal entry said that the story was told to her by her son. The story detailed that Kirsten had been grabbed in her room and taken to a nearby smaller city and a small home where Kirsten had been tortured and then murdered. Police believed that this was the real thing because the details inside of that journal were very specific and they fit in with what they already knew, even if that was limited. The journal also said that everything that had happened to Kirsten had been videotaped. The police tracked down the son who had reportedly relayed the story to his mother, and he told police that it wasn't he who had committed the heinous crimes that were written in the journal. He said that he only knew about it. He said that he knew the people who had reportedly kidnapped Kirsten and killed her, and that the house that they had used to commit the crimes, though, was known to him because it belonged to his girlfriend at the time. As you can imagine, every type of officer and investigator swarmed upon that house, and one of the first things that they did was use luminol to see if there was any traces of blood inside of the house. Well, one investigator said that the entire house lit up like a Christmas tree under the luminol, showing blood pools and blood splatter all over the house. Investigators obviously believed that this blood belonged to Kirsten, and so they believed that the evidence that they had been searching for 10 years by this point was likely all inside of and outside of this very house. The blood was sent in for testing, and investigators started to excavate all over the property of the home, believing that they would find evidence and possibly even Kirsten's remains there. Sadly, though, no remains and no additional evidence was to be found within the home. Inside of the house, though, they found a box that contained nearly 100 videotapes. As I mentioned earlier, the journal entry had stated that there was a video of the crimes, and so, painstakingly, investigators started to watch the tapes, worried that at any moment they would come across something very grisly. In the end, there was nothing on the tapes, though. Furthermore, the blood that had been sent in for testing came back, and it was determined that the blood was very clearly all over the scene, but it was not even human blood. Investigators learned that everything had clearly been a wild goose chase or a lie, whether planned by someone or not. So much time and money was wasted looking into this lead, and it sadly, like almost everything before it, led nowhere. The next jumpstart that would come to the case was when a new detective, Detective Miller, was put onto the case, and he was determined to look into Kirsten's case with a fresh set of eyes and to look at all of the evidence from the very beginning. While he was looking back at everything, something jumped out at him, and it's quite mind-blowing. The blood on the window and the blood on the underwear at the crime scene had never been tested. It really is crazy to me. I don't understand how that blood was never run through any system or tested at all. And thankfully, Detective Miller was very thorough, and when he sent that blood in for testing, it did come back, and it had matched with an unknown male profile. Investigators then ran the DNA profile through CODIS in hopes that they would find a match with a former criminal, but it did come back without a match. Investigators then met with family, friends, neighbors, really everyone that had ever been spoken to in the aftermath of Kirsten's disappearance, and they started to ask those same people to submit DNA samples so that they could test those against the samples found in the house and on Kirsten's underwear. The problem was, though, everyone that investigators spoke with willingly gave a DNA sample and cooperated thoroughly. Investigators started at that point to worry that the DNA match was too late, and that the person who had left the sample behind perhaps was never even spoken to. And then came the break in the case that people had so long been waiting for. In October of 2015, a phone call would come in to investigators that there was indeed a match between the DNA that they had collected from people and the DNA that was found at the scene. The match was with a man who had been a neighbor, who actually only lived two houses away from Kirsten and her family. His home was actually visible from the backyard of the home that Kirsten was taken from. His name was Anthony Joseph Palma. Anthony was actually one of the first people that investigators had spoken to when they started to look for Kirsten. He told investigators back in 1997 that he had awakened around 3 a.m. because of his dog, which was outside, and the dog had started to bark incessantly. He said that he had simply got out of bed, retrieved his dog, and then returned to bed. When police brought him back in for questioning in 2015, they decided to play coy at first, wondering if Anthony would remember his story and if he would tell the same story. They wanted to see if they could catch him or get him to confess. Investigators told Anthony that they were again looking into the case and that they were speaking to everyone once more in hopes that they would come across information that they had not previously heard or that might have been missed. Anthony said that he was always happy to help, and that was because he was a state employee, and as such, it was part of his job to cooperate with law enforcement in every situation. Investigators said that all of the reports only said that Anthony was a lovely man and that he was loved by all of the people in the neighborhood. They said that they had been told that the kids in the neighborhood would even come by and Anthony would buy them pizza. He had offered a safe place for the children. In response, Anthony said that the majority of the neighborhood was made up of retirees, and so he would help seniors with anything that he could because he knew that as they were aging, they could not do certain things for themselves. During the interview, which you can find online in its entirety, Anthony was very unflappable and very casual and even very calm. Investigators would then read Anthony his Miranda rights, and they asked him to again tell them about the night that Kirsten had gone missing. Anthony said that the only thing he could really remember about that day 18 years earlier was what happened afterwards. He remembered talking to police, he remembered talking to Shannon, he remembered talking to neighbors, and everything that went along with that. He said that he recalled it being just like any other normal day. The night before, he had gotten off work, come home, had dinner, and watched TV. He said that he really didn't know Shannon or the two girls very well at all. He actually said that the only connection that he had with the family at all was the fact that a friend of his had lived in the house and rented there before Shannon moved in. Anthony said that he had been in the house before, but well before Shannon and the kids had lived there. Investigators saw that they were not going to get anything of a confession from Anthony without prodding, and that is when the investigators dropped the bombshell on him that there had been a match to the DNA that was found at the home the night that Kirsten went missing. They told him that the DNA was a match to the DNA that he had given to them, and they said that because of that, they knew that he was lying, and that he had been both inside of the home and outside of the home. Believe it or not, Anthony still said that he had not been there since his friend had moved away. Anthony really just kept denying everything. Seemingly, Anthony didn't know that the fact that his DNA was a full match and the science behind that proved beyond really any shadow of doubt that he had been present at the home on the night that Kirsten had been kidnapped. Detective Miller would finally enter the interrogation room, and he would show Anthony a photograph of Kirsten. Anthony's immediate reaction was to push the photograph away from himself, as if putting distance between he and the photograph, and he said that he could not help Detective Miller. When pressed, Anthony just said that he did not do anything to Kirsten, and he did not help anyone else do anything to Kirsten. Investigators at that point realized that they were not going to get a confession at all, but they also knew that they really didn't need one. They arrested Anthony Palma for the murder of Kirsten. 1 month after Anthony was arrested, while in jail, he actually made an attempt to take his own life by slitting his wrists. The injuries, though, were not even severe enough to send him to a hospital. He was, however, put on suicide watch after that. Investigators even believed that there were at least two more cases and maybe many more cases of sexual assault and possibly worse in Anthony's past. Anthony's trial would begin in October of 2017, over 20 years after Kirsten was taken from her bedroom, and the DNA evidence against him ensured that Anthony was found guilty. The jury took less than 2 hours to deliberate before returning with that guilty verdict. Anthony Palma was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Anthony waived his right to an appeal, but he did seemingly keep one thing to himself. He never disclosed what had happened after he took Kirsten from her room, and he never disclosed the location of Kirsten's body. During Anthony's sentencing hearing, as a part of that, Faith and Shannon would read their victim impact statements to Anthony, and they even told him that they had already forgiven him for what he had done to Kirsten. Shannon would even write to Anthony in prison and express that she hoped that one day he would feel the desire to tell her what had happened to her daughter. Shannon said that she did truly believe that that day would come. Sadly, that day, though, would not come. Anthony wound up serving less than 2 years of his prison sentence before he was found deceased in his prison cell at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. It was January 11th of 2019, and Anthony was found to be underneath a blanket in his cell. The guards made his cellmate remove what was on top of him, and he was found to have died from ligature strangulation and blunt force trauma to the head. Anthony's cellmate was also a convicted killer. As we've talked about in the past, including episode 53 and the Kingston Penitentiary Riot, there really is a hierarchy, even in prison, for prisoners. People who murder children and sexually assault children are generally at the bottom of that list, which is believed to have been why Anthony was killed by his cellmate. In the aftermath of Anthony's murder, Shannon came out and said that she will not be rejoicing at all in the death of Anthony because she had already forgiven him for the murder, and she had also hoped that one day he would in fact bring her and her family the closure that they so sadly needed and still need and do deserve. Her one desire now is to retrieve the remains of Kirsten so that she can be properly buried and properly remembered. Shannon said, quote, "God's love and forgiveness got us to Anthony Palma's arrest. It got us through Anthony Palma's arrest. It got us through the trial, and I anticipate it will get us through whatever is next. I'm not celebrating his death. I do pray for his family. It's not lost on me that he has a family and people that care about him." Unquote. The grace that Shannon showed to Anthony is something that I think is, frankly, incomprehensible to most of us. For most of us, thankfully, we cannot comprehend what it would be like to have our child taken from us. But even more than that, we cannot understand looking the monster in the eye that took our child and telling them that they are forgiven. In the Bible, Mark chapter 11, verse 25 says, "But when you are praying, first forgive anyone you are holding a grudge against, so that your Father in heaven will forgive your sins too." Shannon is a living and breathing example of that. This woman had been through hell in her life long before her daughter was taken away from her by Anthony. But she stood steadfastly in this verse. That much is absolutely clear. As much as her life had been destroyed, and as much as it hurt that her daughter was taken away from her, she stood in front of Anthony and made sure that he knew that she had forgiven him. She knew that she had been given a second chance in life, and that she had been forgiven. And she made sure that he knew, too, that he was being extended that same grace. If only each and every one of us could live our lives that way for transgressions that are often so much less than what Shannon faced. So, for Shannon and Faith, and for everyone else that knew Kirsten and the family, I extend the appeal that they still have. This family deserves to know what happened to Kirsten, and more than that, they deserve to be reunited with her remains so that they can give her the burial that she deserves. If anyone out there knows what happened to Kirsten after she was taken from her home, it's never too late to give closure to the people that loved her. As with any case where there have not been remains found, there are age progression photos online of what Kirsten would look like if she is still alive today. And while it seems pretty clear that she is no longer with us and that she is in heaven, there is still a possibility. There is always a chance that Anthony may have acted, for example, on someone else's behalf and taken the fall out of fear or something like that. So don't completely rule that out either. I will share those photos across our socials and also have the age progression photo of Kirsten on the show poster. I also want to serve this case as a reminder. There are people that hear about things like the death of Anthony and they laud his murder. They thank the killer. They say that the man got what he deserved, but those people are removed from the situation, and frankly, it does bother me that these types of people feel that their personal narrative is more important than the narrative of Kirsten's own mom. Shannon had hope that one day Anthony would share what happened to Kirsten, and Shannon truly had forgiven the man for what he had done. So, the people that spew that kind of venom really need to learn to check themselves. There are plenty of cases like this one where death perhaps is not the best answer. So, with that, I will wrap up another episode and another week of the podcast. As I always do, I appeal to you to join the conversation on social media. I'm very active on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. And do your part in helping the true crime community and the world around us to be just a little bit better than the whole of its parts. There can be positive people in the true crime world. I will end with a simple thank you, as always. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting Gone But Never Forgotten. Be well, and most importantly, be better. I'll see you back here next week.